When one decides to make public performance their vocation, many reasons come into play beyond simply choosing a profession. For some, it's a natural talent that needs showcasing, an exuberant, extroverted personality that is always quote-unquote on and needs to shine. But in the world of music, specifically rock and roll, the genre oftentimes attracts a different specimen of performer. Rock and roll has often been the conduit for phoenixes to rise from the ashes and introverts to spring to life. Rock and roll fosters pomp. It's all about enchantment and is a modern-day Brothers Grimm fable come to life where the frog becomes a prince ad infinitum. It's also the reason why there are so many broken people attracted to the profession of rock and roll, all seeking some sort of corrective fulfillment, but in a cobbled, impetuous way. How do I know this? Well, can't say I'm exempt from what I just laid out, so I know of that which I speak. There's definitely the excitement of writing hot rock and roll, recording it, performing it, touring around and playing it night after night in a different city. But over the years, I've noticed when it really pops for me is when I get some sort of validation from peers, especially people in bands that I grew up admiring, long before I tried my hand at it. Of course, there's been the backside to it all, too. The painful sting of disappointment by heroes I've met that have let me down, but no real harm done. I chalk it all up to flying too close to the sun. In all the time I've been in this game, there have been notable meetings and encounters with musical heroes, and that's always been the most satisfying feeling in this godforsaken rock and roll game. However, no matter how far you go with your music, no matter how many bands you meet and play with, no matter how many crowds you play in front of, nothing, and I mean nothing, beats the acceptance and validation one gets from one's own scene. I grew up in Toronto, and I've said this before, growing up as a metalhead during my impressionable teen years, it was Sacrifice that were kings to me. They were the band on the scene, as far as I was concerned, that had made it. They were on Metal Blade Records, for starters. They were touring, putting out albums. They were name-checked in all the cool metal mags. To me, growing up in Scarborough, where Sacrifice were from, it was inspiring to see a band come from my dismal suburban haunts and make a name for themselves. I credit their rise to lifting my spirits when our band would inevitably hit yet another roadblock. We didn't play the same style of music, but we all know hard rock and heavy metal are musical cousins. Over the years, and even though they're all dispersed throughout the continent, I've managed to meet and get to know the guys. I even had singer-guitarist Rob Urbanati on for episode number 136 back in 2016. When we've played in the Detroit area, Joe Rico always shows up, and I must admit, it's a bit intimidating throwing out a guitar solo, knowing Joe's watching. When they asked me to sing Iron Fist with them for their reunion show in Toronto at the Opera House on February 27th, 2016 for Inertia Entertainment's 20th anniversary, it was one of the greatest onstage moments I've ever had in my life. This is no exaggeration. Like I stated, supreme validation from the kings of your home scene is felt deeply. Maybe to the sold-out crowd at the Opera House, it was simply a guest walk-on. But to me, it was such a deep-rooted moment that brought things full circle. As someone who grew up feeling like the outsider in almost every facet of my life, much like I think a lot of metalheads did, thus their attraction to the scene, this moment did a lot to diminish internal issues within me. Let's just say that. There's a photograph out there taken by Joe's wife, Amy. I think I might have even Instagrammed it at one point, of me standing side stage between Joe and Brian Taylor, two very formidable figures in the early Toronto metal scene. And man, that should definitely be in a frame on the wall of my place. So it has been a long time coming to have Joe Rico on this podcast. Man, I can't tell you how cool it is to have Joe to talk metal and to talk about his passion for jiu-jitsu and his stronghold Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy he owns and runs in Livonia, Michigan, found online at strongholdbjj.com. Thanks to Blue Mic Microphones and Skull Candy Headphones for the support. This podcast supports Chino Loco's restaurants because when I want a fish burrito, I want it stuffed with chow mein noodles. Okay, here we go. Joe Rico is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Leonard, Guinness, Danko's go out to love for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down, down. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's co-host. Download for free on SoundCloud and iTunes. Sometimes Damien from Fucked Up stops by and hangs out too.
When the weather is bad and there's nothing much to do, take a listen, would you now, to what Danko Jones would do. It's the middle of the night and you better do it fast. Turn the speakers up loud for Danko's podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready because the Danko Jones podcast starts. No!
Hello.
How's it going?
It's going good. It's good to hear your voice. The last time we saw each other was that Inertia birthday bash. Inertia Entertainment.
Yeah, that was a blast.
I don't know, man. For me, it was like a check off the old list. You know, like
yeah, that was pretty fun. That was like I said. Like we didn't, you know, like we didn't even plan on doing anything like that. And it just came up. I'm like, yeah, let's do it. So it took us like a couple of days to get that tight. And that was good.
Yeah. I didn't want to feel like I was some sort of fanboy in your rehearsal room, but I was like taking photos. Like I was just,
we feel the same way.
Oh, and the get up in Toronto with you guys and to sing Iron Fist, I mean, I know there's I looked out in the crowd that night and I know there's a lot of puzzled faces but when we started, but then I think it went over really well, you know.
Oh, yeah, it went over really good. Everybody talked about that for a while.
Yeah, there's like and you know, Junior was there and Brian Taylor was there before I got on stage and after I got off stage, so it felt really cool to have those guys go, "Good job."
Yeah, it was just good to have everybody there, you know. That like all our shows are always better when we know everybody there.
Yeah, and I know how Sacrifice is. Like, it's you know, you guys are in four different parts of the country or three different parts of the country, and you guys have your own separate lives, and you come together for on special occasions to do the band. And the last time you guys did it, if I'm not mistaken, was in Japan. Am I right?
Yeah, we just got back like a few weeks ago. Yeah, we were over there, played a couple of shows. It's always a blast, you know. It never ceases to blow me away that like after all this time, people actually still want to see us and get into it. And it's a good feeling, you know, that I guess that at some point we did something okay.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in Japan, like, how are the fans there? Like, it's the thrash metal fans.
It's kind of odd because there's certain people and it was like time stood still for them, you know? I mean, we're still part of their, like, you know, the patches on their jacket, you know, we're like right up there with like Sodom and, you know, everybody else. It was great. And there's other people that just, you know, well, you know, I've listened to you guys in the past and, you know, I'm no longer into it, but I'm going to come to the show. And, you know, and so they look like us now, you know, like, right. Like us older guys now.
Right. And Japan, I mean, we've only been to Japan once and it was amazing trip. And I've always wanted to go back there. But how are the how is the metal crowd? Like, we've never really, we played a very mainstream festival when we did go, so it was hard to gauge. But how is a metal crowd? Are they like moshing and how? What is?
They do. They you know, we encourage that definitely when they play. But what separates Japanese audiences is after you play the song and the initial cheer, like, hey, you know, that's great, yeah, clap or whatever, then they go completely silent.
Right.
It's just so weird because I'm just kind of like, are they getting into this or not? But they are, you know, they're just, I don't know, they just seem very silent in between songs. And there's nothing wrong with that, because you can see when we're playing, they're getting right into it. So it's amazing.
Yeah. And it made it sweeter because Razor was out at the festival too, right? I mean.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Anytime we played with Razor, it was always good. And then, you know, there was, you know, guys that we know from the past, you know, like the guys from At War and Blood Feast, you know, they're just like new friends of ours. We played with them in the past, but it was like a different incarnation of the band. And yeah, like now they're super tight, super heavy, you know, and because I was not a fan, you know, I never really listened to much of their stuff until Japan. But, you know, after watching them, I actually went out and got their stuff so I can listen to it. And it's great, great stuff.
And Hyrax was out there too, right?
Yes.
And Caton's still, you know, doing it.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's like one of the highlights of the trip, you know, just to be able to hang out with Caton and watch them play and hear his stories and everything else. And, you know, I mean, the guy's just, he's just a great person, great human being, and he loves music, you know, much like you do, you know, and he's into everything. I mean, he listens to everything, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. I follow him on Instagram, and he lives it, man. Like, he's wearing his Saxon shirt today, I bet, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, and on top of that, you know, like, sitting in the back and just, you know, shooting the breeze with him. And, I mean, just his knowledge of, like Motown and R&B. Mm. I mean, it's pretty vast.
That's,
you know,
amazing.
So he's a music fan, you know what I mean? And just a super, super human being, you know, real nice guy.
And that thrash, the True Thrash Fest, was that just did you have one set? Like, was that, you traveled all the way there for one set, or there another show, or?
There were three nights.
Okay.
Three nights for the fest, and we played two of the three nights.
Right. Okay.
The first show we had, we were just before Razor, and then the next night we were just before Blood Feast. So yeah, it was really good. I had a great time.
Yeah, because sometimes, like, when you travel that far away for one show, it just doesn't make sense. Like, so
yeah,
they usually,
yeah, I mean,
pad it with a couple or three, two or three.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and the last time, this is our second time in Japan, and the last time that we did that, we just flew, and then we just played like the one show, and then we've done that before where we, like, I believe, well, the last time we were before Japan, when we went to Peru, we flew out there, we did one show, and then we flew back. It was pretty odd, but that was a lot of fun.
How long were you there in Japan for?
I think we were there for about 6 days. So we played two shows, and we had, you know, a couple of rehearsal days, but mostly it was just, we were just there to hang out because we wanted to attend the fest also, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you got to, like, visit the sites. Like, it was in Osaka. Were you able to go to any other cities, or just Osaka?
Just Osaka.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much to do, and it's like, it's such a culture shock. Like, every time I've gone there, it never ceases to amaze me what an amazing country that is.
Yeah.
You know, and they just don't seem like it, because you don't hear about it, but they're pretty advanced over there too, which is great, you know.
And something that I think has recently. Well, that's due to, you know, Metallica, Slayer, Megadeth, and Anthrax all touring together. Here in Canada, we've all looked at our own metal scene, And I think it's pretty understood that we have our own big four, which you guys are obviously, I think, the kings of. And then there's Annihilator, Razor, of course. And then would the fourth one be, what would the fourth, the big four, right? Anvil, I guess, would be the fourth? Or
Anvil would probably be in the four. You know, I definitely have, like, my own four.
Yeah, so do I.
But you know, that's the common four that everybody has. Yes, you know, Anvil's got to be in there, and Annihilator has to be in there. You know,
I think Voivod would be the four. Would make
to, yes. Yeah. To me, Voivod is probably number one of the four. Voivod in itself is, I mean, they don't sound like anybody. They were just so original. Mm. They kind of like they made their own way. And that, to me, that's, you know, that's very commendable. And plus, I love their tunes. I love how unpredictable they are. And I love how dissonant they can get. And because those are my favorite things. I'm not much of a, like, a melody guy. I like more of, like, the what the heck was that kind of thing, you know?
Right. Yeah. And they were the pinnacle of that. They defined that almost in metal. Yeah. Mine would be you guys, Voivod, Annihilator, and Razor. Those would be my big four. And you guys kind of did that in, I believe, the Calgary Metal Festival a couple years back, where they tried to do something like that. And I thought that was really commendable of them, and including all you guys. It was. I hope they do it again, or they do it in Toronto. It would be amazing.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, like a gig like that would do well anywhere now, because I mean, for some reason, it's just coming back around, and people are appreciating more of the older stuff. You know, I mean, I hear a lot of guys, and I talk to a lot of guitar players, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, like you guys are such a big influence, and you know, because of your sound. And I never ever even dreamed to be anything like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
Like, I was just this kid trying to play guitar so I can go play shows and stuff. You
know? Yeah, I totally understand that feeling. But to have it kind of boomerang back at you, especially after all these years.
Yes.
That must be very, very satisfying.
It's very satisfying, and I'm so appreciative, and I'm so grateful that, you know, people give a shit about, like, anything that we did. You know, I mean, when we started, like, we would write these songs, it was because these were the songs that we wanted to hear. You know, like, you know, we'd listen to Dark Angel and we'd come up with something similar and be like, yeah, you know, that's cool. But then, like, you know, in the process, it became ours, and people saw that, and it's like, and it, that's just how it shaped up, and it was, and we're really appreciative of, and the people that still, like, to this day, I mean, it blows me away when I talk to people, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, we still listen to you and this from all this time. And I'm like, you know, that's pretty cool, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've, you know, in our travels, when people find out we're from Canada, the usual thing is obviously Rush. They go, oh, Rush. Oh yeah. Yes, Canada. But depending on where I am, it's also Sacrifice and Voivod.
Yeah. I hear that a lot. And then, I mean, and I, you know, I've, you know, people have told me that, you know, the guys in Ghost are into us, and, you know, just all these like bands that you never expect. And like I said, I'm like really grateful of that, you know, I'm really appreciative, and it makes it that we did something, you know?
Oh, I do know the guys in Ghost, have name checked you guys. I do know that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, man. I mean, that's really cool, though. And then, again, when we were in Calgary and we played with Candlemass, you know, and just meeting a pair there, the keyboard player who was in Spiritual Beggars, and talking to him about it, I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this guy, like knows us, you know, and, like, everything he's done, we've loved, you know, that kind of thing. We get, like, super starstruck all the time, too.
Oh, Pear's a great guy, man. He's been on the podcast. And even, like, I think I remember I did a interview once with Boba Fett from the helicopters. He plays keyboards. And he goes, so you're from Canada, right? And I said, yes. He goes, well, Nicky Anderson has a question for you. Nicky from Entombed and Helicopters. And he wants to know if you've heard these bands. And he name dropped, he listed all these bands, Sacrifice, Pile Driver. He had, you know, and so I was like, yeah, of course, you know, of course. So it's cool that, you know, these guys who people really look up to today who are, you know, out there doing it like Nicky are fans of you guys and name check you guys. Same with, I mean, I look at those, you know, Dark Throne has that song called Canadian Metal. Don't tell me those guys don't know, you know, the Big Four, you know.
That's amazing, man. I mean, and it's, you know, because you growing up, you know, we were like that too, you know. Like, I mean we just loved all these bands, and like just recently, you know, we started meeting, you know, a few people, and it's like, I mean, I think it's pretty cool. You know, it's pretty cool that this little band of ours from like Toronto is recognized, you know, other than just there.
Have you guys played any of the German metal festivals like Wacken or Belgium Grass Pop or anything like that?
No, I wish, and we've all discussed it. We've only played, you know, like Keep It True, that was in Germany. That was pretty good.
Oh, right, yeah.
We played with Satan at that show, and that was, I mean, I was, that was like this, watching the second coming for me, you know? Wow. I mean, watching them play side stage was probably like the highlight of that trip.
And, if, you know...
And, I mean, we don't, I mean, no, I wish, you know, we've never been invited, or maybe we have. I just don't know to play any of the bigger festivals.
The scheduling for the four of you guys must be kind of a little bit of a nightmare, because you guys are in three different places and you guys all have, you know, day jobs and careers and families, and it must be tough.
It is. It's really tough. And, you know, like anything, if anything comes up, I mean, we get to sit at this round table and discuss, you know, like, you know, how much vacation time do we have, you know, or, you know, what's going on, like that, you know, the family that we can't, you know, be out of town. You know, there's a lot of variables. That's why, you know, for us, typically one, two, maybe even three shows a year, because, you know, like I said, well, like you mentioned, like everybody's got a day job, you know, everybody has, you know, responsibilities and things with the family that, you know, we're up there now. So now we got to take care of this stuff too.
You know, I have to admit, man, when I was at Wacken, we played Wacken open air. They've got the metal market, and there's I bought it because I saw it. I had to buy it. It was a Sacrifice patch and a Sacrifice pin.
Yeah. I see a lot of stuff like that actually. And, you know, I mean, and I had one of these Sacrifice pins or whatever, and you know, like that. Those are the things that, like, it's nice to have, but I give those things away. I'd rather see somebody else enjoy them, you know.
Yeah,
it's nice that like, yeah. I mean, when we go see shows, you know, and I see people wearing our shirts or patches. I mean, it's that's just pretty cool, you know. That's a pretty cool tribute to like a band that you like, you know.
Yeah. But I just bring it up because when I was buying it, I'm like, well, I know this isn't going to the band, but you know, it's on my jean jacket, the patch, yeah. You know? So,
yeah, I mean, I'm all about that. I mean, I think it's cool, you know, support and like, you know, yeah, none of it's going to the band, but if it gets the name out, you know, I'm cool with that. You know, I don't have an issue. You know, you see a lot of those, like, you know, like I said, we'd be like out of town and you see some guy's patch. I'm like, I have no clue where that came from or whatever, but hey, it's cool, you know? And, yeah. And you see a lot of things like that. I mean, I remember coming to Detroit, like back in the day when we were just, you know, like playing these small bars, and we would go to a place and they have bootleg shirts of ours. And I'm like, you know, oh, that's bad, blah, blah, blah. And but in my head, I'm thinking, that's pretty cool, man. You know, there's nothing wrong with that to me. I think that's cool.
Yeah. Well, so last fall, I went to the Sacred Reich show in Toronto, and I met a friend of yours who's a friend of Phil Rinn's from Sacred Reich, Chris Robinson.
Okay, yeah.
And he started...
Good friend of mine, yeah.
Yeah, and he started kind of giving me an update on you, and I was like, yeah, you know, I've been meaning to get Joe on the podcast. I had Rob on. We kind of briefly talked about it, and then Chris said, Joe's just opened up a jiu-jitsu school, and I said, wow, I would love to talk to Joe about that. And that was one of the things that I reached out to you about after that Sacred Reich show. And tell me about all of this, please.
Well, you know, yes, I did just recently. This is our second year out now. This very small jiu-jitsu school. That was something that I found later on. I wasn't doing Sacrifice, and I wasn't really playing, and I was just, you know, picking up bad habits and sitting around doing nothing, you know?
Right.
And the suggestion of a couple of my friends, I went out and tried it, and I got hooked, and I've been doing it for years and years and years, and I finally decided that, you know, I wanted to open a school. And I mean, and it's just the reason why I did it is just because so I can train, you know what I mean? And, you know, I have a day job. So this is just kind of like a hobby of mine that's kind of turned into a business. And, you know, we're like, you know, after like a couple of years, we've got like, you know, 14, 15, 16 people strong. So we're a very small school, but you know, all my students that compete, they all medal and they do well. So, and it's just, I mean, for me, like I gave up a lot of things. I don't drink, I don't do anything like that. And I just replaced it with jiu-jitsu. I have a very, very addictive personality that usually when I do something, I do it like 100%. Like, you know, if I decide to collect t-shirts, I'm going to have t-shirts and guitars and all that stuff. And jiu-jitsu just happened to fill that space for me. So I do that like every day. That's just like my thing. You know, that's just become a part of my lifestyle. And, I mean, it's changed a lot for me, like, you know, mentally, physically, everything else. But yeah, it's a very strong thing in my life. So I decided I was going to share that knowledge, whatever little knowledge I have of jiu-jitsu, I was going to share that with my community. And so I just decided, hey, let's open a jiu-jitsu school and go for it. So yeah, it's been rough. I've never been like a, you know, a very business-minded person or anything, but this is what's, you know, this is a good learning experience for me, and it's so far so good. I'm having a blast with it.
So it's called Stronghold Jiu-Jitsu. Am I right?
Yep, that is the name of our school and our team. This is the Stronghold Jiu-Jitsu Academy.
And it's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yes. Yep. It's just like, you know, like we don't mix any. You go to a lot of gyms these days, and they're mixing MMA and everything else. And this is just straight up Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. It's like, you know, like I'm just kind of, you know, carrying the torch for the forefathers of jiu-jitsu here. Yeah, so it's very traditional. And I don't know. I mean, that's like it seems odd because I talk to people about it. They're like, what? You do that? I'm like, yeah. You know, it just so happens. You know, it's just like one of my hobbies that turned into something a little bit bigger and became a business also.
Yeah, because I mean, I've followed you on Twitter and Instagram, of course, so I know that you have always been practicing jiu-jitsu. But yeah. when Chris told me that you opened up a school, that kind of surprised me. I don't think you made a big splash about it on social media either, right?
No, I didn't, because it's similar to like our tunes, right? Like I wanted it to be like a word of mouth place, because right. I have really nothing to brag about. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to go, oh, this and come and see this or whatever. It's just like, hey, we're just a jiu-jitsu school. We're like, you know, we're open to other affiliations and teams. Just come and train with us. You know what I mean? And it's like, and I've always wanted it that way because, you know, in my travels and a lot of like all these other jiu-jitsu schools, like there is none like that. You know, we're just kind of like a, you know, like just out of the basement kind of bunch of guys hanging out and training, you know?
To me, that would as an outsider, that would always seem more authentic anyways.
Yeah. I mean, and that carries over in like everything I do, everything. Like I don't like to make a big splash about anything. I don't like to make big announcements or anything about it. I just, you know, I just do it. Right. And for me, like with jiu-jitsu, like I said, you know, it's like, you know, with sacrifice, it was, you know, it was just that we're underground. This is how it is. People get into us, whatever. We're happy in our own little niche here, you know. And that's the same with our jiu-jitsu school. I mean, like in this area alone where I live, there's probably four or five schools, but each is different. You know, everybody offers something different, and I think we offer something different to the community. You know, like the majority of the guys I train with, you know, like, I have a couple of people that want to be champions, who are just like medal chasers. And then, you know, the majority of my students are like, you know, dads who sit at the office all day, who just need to blow off some steam at the end of the day, or guys that, you know, they want to get a workout in, but, you know, going to the gym and running around in circles and lifting weights is just not a fun way, you know, whereas here, you know, we're all like, you know, once you're on the mat, you're just like everybody else. It doesn't matter. You know, like, I mean, there's guys that I train with that, like, if it wasn't for jiu-jitsu, I wouldn't even be anywhere near these people. I wouldn't be hanging out with them. You know, they're like, right, all attorneys and, you know, doctors and things like that. But like, you know, when we're on the mat, it's all good. You know, it's, we're all friends, and it works well. It's a good thing that binds us all together.
So I'm not very familiar with the martial art, but is there there's obviously like hierarchy of belts. So are you like what would be your title? Like a grandmaster or?
No. I'm not even at a black belt level yet. It takes like about 15 years to get there. So there are five belts in jiu-jitsu, and it starts with white, and there's blue, purple, brown, and black. Well, right now I'm right in the middle of my brown belt. So I'm like, probably 2 years into it. So probably a couple more years, maybe three, I would say maybe three, maybe 4 years before I get my black belt. I'm like that far away.
Right. You know? So you train at another school? Is that how it works?
Well, I was training at a school close by here, but my instructor had decided to sell off the school. Him and his family had moved to Florida. So I, with his permission, you know, and his guidance, that's how I'm running my school. So I'm technically still under him. So he's the one that promotes me and everything like that. But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm still under him, although he's not in town anymore. He's still back and forth.
Right.
And he flies in here for work, you know, and he'll come and train with us. And, you know, that's when he grades us and checks us out, make sure we're doing okay.
So so whenever I, you know, I hear that you're obviously, you've been doing this for years, you're high up in the martial art, you can break, you're basically a one man killing machine. You are a weapon. You are a walking weapon.
You know, the weird part about anything like that is, you know, obviously when you get into martial arts, you've got your why you're starting, but the more you progress in it, and the more you devote most of your time, that always changes. So now, I mean, even though daily I'm out there, I'm teaching guys how to, like, you know, choke each other out, and make people claustrophobic, and, you know, just control the situation. Those things, like, the more knowledge I have of that, the less that I want to even do that to anybody. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Because I recently had Harley Flanagan on the podcast.
Yes.
He's into jiu-jitsu. He teaches jiu-jitsu as well.
Yeah. Yes. I'm actually well aware. I follow him all the time. You know, I'm a Cro-Mags fan. So,
right.
You know, and then just to hear that, you know, those guys trained, and the guys in Biohazard, guys in Shelter. I mean, like, everybody trains, but like nobody really talks about it, you know, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and he said something very similar to what you just said, is like, the more he knows, like, he can't even touch anybody.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
he just knows,
yeah.
He, you know, it kind of humbles you in a way. Your knowledge and strength.
Absolutely. You know, and with jiu-jitsu, I mean, you get just by training it, you know, you've got some knowledge there that not many people know. And I mean, you've got a huge responsibility. You know, you can, like I said, you can go either way. You can be like the dickhead that shoves people around, or you can be the one looking out for people, making sure everybody's okay. You know what I mean? And it just depends on your personality. And the majority of the people that I know that train jiu-jitsu are like that. You know, they're just like always looking out for other people. And, you know, it's so humbling that, you know, you just, as you, like I said, as you progress in it, it just changes your mindset. You know, it has a lot of way, many ways of changing your outlook, and definitely a good filter inside of a school, because everybody who comes in there, jiu-jitsu is hard, man. I mean, I'll be the first to tell everybody that, like my kid, the kids that come and train or whatever, it's hard. It's not easy. I mean, and it takes a certain kind of person to do it, you know, like jiu-jitsu is for everybody, but not everybody's for jiu-jitsu. And it's good to gauge people. They'll come in there, these big, giant, tough guys or whatever. And you already know. I can already tell. It's just like your ego is going to prevent you from excelling in this. So either you get rid of that or you're not going to last. And that's how it has to be, you know? I mean, you can't go in there with an ego, because there's always somebody faster, there's always somebody bigger, and there's always somebody stronger.
What is it that draws guys who are into heavy music to this particular martial art?
Well,
you know Harley, the Biohazard guys. You mentioned Shelter Dudes are into it.
Yeah,
like Ray Capo's a jiu-jitsu guy.
Yeah, I think so. It's either him or one of the other guys that were into
Purcell,
it.
Right.
Yep. And then, you know, and Maynard, he's like a brown belt too, you know, from Tool.
Oh, okay.
You know, so, you know, like, I mean, if you look it up, the guy from Five Finger Death Punches, I think he's a purple belt now too. Some guy in Trivium trains, you know. And I think the allure with that is, you know, we play like heavy, aggressive music, you know what I mean? Whereas jiu-jitsu gives us a balance, because like as violent as it can be, and as you know you're just, you know, it's so masculine and this and that, it's also very gentle. It teaches you like how to deal with things gently, you know, like rather than using force, to actually use the momentums, and you know, it just all these physics that you have to know, and the knowledge of like human anatomy, you know. And it's and that in itself, that study is very calming, and I think it works well. You know, like there's nothing more I want to do. After playing guitar and just dive bombs and growls and all this stuff, is go and train, because it just kind of like silences you. You know, like you kind of like it just settles things down for me. Like I've always said, if I didn't do jiu-jitsu, I'd be probably sitting here popping Prozacs like they were Tic Tacs, you know what I mean?
So it really calms you down. So you do this every day?
Every day. I train every day. I've got classes every day. You know, a couple hours here and there. You know, I don't do it for very long, but usually, like, you know, I'll get home from work at 5. By 6:30, I'm at my kids' class. You know, 7:30, I'm at my adults' class. Then I'm done for the day. Wow. You know, so it's good, because, you know, throughout the day, again, you know, like I'm at my day job, I'm sitting in a cubicle, you know, all day long, you know, that's what I'm doing, you know, and just like negotiating and, you know, buying things and all that stuff. And then when I turn my computer off, I get to leave that and then go and, you know, blow off steam, or just training jiu-jitsu in itself is for me, it's a relaxing. You know how people will come home from work, you know, and like crack open a beer and, you know, watch TV and relax. My relaxing is to go and just get beat up by these guys.
Wow,
that to me is very relaxing.
That is very commendable. I mean, I don't even know how to. That's an interesting way to look at things. I don't even know where to begin with that.
And it's rough, because the, like, also like leading up to like any shows, that we play, I kind of have to scale back.
Right.
In jiu-jitsu, you know, not that everybody's like out to hurt you or whatever, but it's a physical activity and you can get hurt. So I always kind of scale back, and that just drives me crazy because it, for me, I train hard like all the time, you know? So, but yeah, like for now, you know, like I'll scale back, you know, practice guitar and get the shows or whatever. But then as soon as those are over, I come back and right back into it.
Yeah. Like if you sprain like a finger,
that would be bad. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you're screwed. So when you guys do these, like you just made me think about practicing, like you guys don't get to practice, even though we practiced for the Toronto show together.
Yeah. Actually all of our shows, we always try to get into town that we're playing maybe 2 days before the show. And then we always schedule a couple of rehearsals just to get rid of the cobwebs and things like that.
Even Osaka? You
know? Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were there. We were there, like, I think 3 days before the show. And, like, we practiced, like, 2 days. We rented a rehearsal place, got the gear in that we were going to use for the shows, just to mess with it, get sounds. And then we run over the set a couple of times. And then, yeah, and then, you know, we're ready. Like, usually, you know, yeah, it takes us, you know, probably two passes and then we're fine.
Wow. All right. Wow. So I guess, well, there is a couple of things I just wanted to say. I don't know if you remember this, but when you guys were working on The Ones That I Condemn, you sent me a demo of Hiroshima. You were working out and I was on tour. We were in Norway when I got your email.
Yeah.
I got so inspired from hearing it. It doesn't sound like it at all. It's a million miles away, but I was just so inspired that I remember so distinctly. I went upstairs, we did sound check, and at the sound check, I came up with the main riff for a song we have called Full of Regret that we ended up making a video for, with Lemmy was in the video. And that all came from your email of Hiroshima that I got to hear and got so fucking jazzed that it just sprouted that riff on stage at soundcheck.
That's so amazing to hear that, because that's like one of my favorite songs of yours too.
Oh,
so
man.
that's just great to hear that. But I think that's great. You know, I mean,
well, we always screw around at soundcheck. You know, like when you have a guitar in your hand and you're amplified.
Oh, absolutely.
But I remembered that riff because when we finished soundcheck, two people in our entourage came up to me and said, "Don't forget that riff," which nobody ever does. They never do that.
that's a great song. That's well put together, well written. I love it. It's so catchy.
Yeah, so it was like from the email. I was like, holy shit, I'm listening to New Sacrifice, man. Oh, my God. And so I was really, you know, really energized and inspired by it. So
that's amazing. Yeah. That's so cool to hear.
And so that leads me to my next question, which is like, are you guys, and I'm pretty sure you're sick and tired of hearing it, but I got to ask, are you guys working on new stuff?
We are. Actually, just a few days ago, I got some rough tracks that Rob sent me, and he wanted me to add a couple of bridges and a couple of riffs, which I haven't really done yet. So, but that's in the works. There are actually four new songs right now as we speak that are in the process of getting processed, you know?
Right.
But they're there. So, and they're actually, they're all very aggressive, a little bit on the faster side. So, yeah, I mean, I don't even know where we're going with these, but I think we're going like more in that vein.
Well, I mean, the ones that I condemn sits very nicely in the Sacrifice discography. I mean, the way you guys are doing it, you know, keeping up with the age, the day, the sound of today. I mean, it's great. And the thing is, the sound of today has actually caught up to you guys. You know what I mean? Like, you guys didn't have to do anything. Like, there's no catching up you guys had to do.
Well, see, like especially for me, the equipment wise, and to this day, I still have like, you know, my original like 5150s, because those are, you know, my amps by choice. Right. Well, when I first played that amp or had a chance to play it, that was the sound that I heard in my head for years. You know, I just didn't know how to convey it. I had like modified Marshalls and put like all these rack effects to it. I go, yeah, it's getting closer. That's getting closer. Well, now when we play or when I do anything, it's just my guitar plugged into my 5150, and that's the sound. You know what I mean? I don't really add anything else to it, because it's just like, oh my gosh, I wish I had this like 20 years ago. You know?
Wow. I think,
but it is. Like I've always asked that when we go to play, you know, they're like, oh, well, what do you want for like a back line? I go, just give me a half stack, a 5150, and we'll call it good. Just make sure it's the first original one, and make sure it's like the first one with like Eddie Van Halen's signature on the back, you know. And it's always worked out, and because it's like I have that amp at home, I memorized my settings. I go there and I do the same settings, and voila, it sounds just like it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Is those? I heard that the 5150 amps today are not the same as when he was promoting them.
Well, the ones that they have today are good. You know, don't get me wrong. Like, right. I love those things too. But the simplicity of the first one, like I'm looking at it right now, and there's 1, 2, 3, 3, 6. There's 10 knobs on it, and that's it. Right. You know, and I think that's 5 too many for me.
yeah.
but I mean, and that, you know, and it works, you know, and I've tried, you know, like we'd go and like I'd try like all the other, you know, super expensive amps, like the Angles and the Diesels, and yeah, I mean, you name it, you know. But it's like I always go back to this, and it's like, well, this is just what I'm comfortable with, I guess.
No overdrive pedal, no nothing.
Nope, none of that. Wow. And the same thing with Rob, where he uses a Mesa Boogie 50 cal and just guitar into that. Well, he uses a noise gate,
right?
You know,
right.
And me, it's just like my guitar into a wah, into a tuner, into the 5150, and that's it. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you on the simplicity of a guitar setup.
Yeah, it's got to be, because I don't like if anything goes wrong, I don't want to trace it down to like a 6-inch patch cable that I need to fix. because I've got this thing lit up like an airline cockpit, and I can't figure out anything else out, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when we travel and we play, like, you know, like, I mean, we're our own roadie. We're our own road crew.
Yeah.
So it's just like, let's just keep it as simple as possible so we can like fix this problem if anything arises, you know?
Yeah. 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 I don't get guys who play like 10 pedals.
And I get that. I mean, there's a spot for that. And I love sure. Players. Like I love players who have that thing too, you know? I mean, but it just doesn't work for me, you know? I mean,
but like as a technical thing, like like you said, it's a nightmare if one tiny patch cable is the reason for your guitar sound breaking down in the middle of a show.
That can ruin your day, absolutely.
It's so crazy. It's like playing with fire to have like 10 pedals in front of you, man.
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely.
My sound's gone down with just like a tuner and an overdrive pedal.
That's really all you need. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, like even back in the day, like in the Sacrifice days when we were using the JCM 800s, because we loved those, you know.
Yeah.
It was just an overdrive pedal into the JCM 800. And that's how we recorded like For Determination. And I think Soldiers was like that too. It was only Apocalypse Inside where we got like stupid. And I got like, you know, like I was carrying around like two, like, 6 space racks with like lights on it and everything, and I'm like, what, you know? Because when we would go out to play shows, I mean, it would take me forever just to haul that stuff inside.
And you're Stratocasters all the way, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
like I use, you know, like I always played Strats. I've always liked it. And then you know, and I've used the LTD, like a ESP LTD, right, for a little while, you know, but it's old and it's beat up. So I've just started, you know, I just took one of my old Strats from the 90s. You know, I had a Strat Plus and I put humbuckers in it. I put a Floyd Rose on it. And yeah, I just metaled it out, and that's going to be, you know, the guitars that I'm going to take, the guitar I'm going to take out now. It's like, yeah, they're simple and I'm comfortable. Then yeah, I mean, they're great. I mean, I've got a Les Paul too, but that's just like my home thing, you know. I think I used that like on the Death tour when we were on tour with Death, and it was just like, it just killed me after a while. My back always hurt, you know.
Yeah, I don't get how people can play Les Pauls live for any longer than half an hour.
right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I'm too old for that.
They're great. I mean, I can't be in the studio without one.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, they're fantastic. They sound amazing.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But yeah, like night after night to play that's just a pain.
Yeah, and Strats are pretty light.
They're pretty light. They are.
Yeah. Yeah.
They are. And it, like, you know, for me, like I've always had like a lot of issues with Strats being too bright. So right now I got one of the guy, he's here. He actually just lives like a few blocks from me, and he works on all my guitars, you know, like, you know, setups and things like that. And right now he's building a Super Strat with a mahogany body. Like, so this is going to be like a Les Paul body, like the same wood as a Les Paul.
Oh, wow.
And, I definitely am interested in that. He's like, oh yeah, we know we'll put like a Floyd on it and everything. So yeah, he's in the process of building that. So hopefully that turns out well, because maybe I'd like to own that.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Joe, thanks, man. This has been great.
Yeah, absolutely, man. This, you know, like I said, like we were trying to do this before, but it just, we finally got this thing going.
Yeah, this is perfect. And it's perfect. Perfect timing and everything, man. And I'm glad we got it down now. This is perfect.
That's awesome, for sure.
Yeah, man. Awesome.
Yeah, no worries. No sweat. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.